Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
Tracy, I just need to take a couple of minutes and vent about something.
That's why I was like, I said my name kind of funny, but it was my, I was saying Tracy Ross, like... That was
you got this
Rebecca.
Look
is something
on your
going
face.
On with you? What's up? What's up?
I need to vent. Okay.
So I've been getting these emails like every single day from one of my credit card companies. And you know what? I'm going to call them out. I'm going to call them
Do
out
it.
On air. It's Capital One.
All right.
All right. So maybe I shouldn't have a Capital One card.
Maybe
that was my fault. But I got a Capital One card recently as like a backup credit card.
Is that because of Alec Baldwin?
Does he
do the commercials for those? Okay.
It wasn't. It was because I'd managed to leave all forms of payment that I have at different bars and not close the cards out, and I needed a new
all
credit
right.
card.
Okay.
That happened. Hi, Mom. That happened. So, anyway, so I signed up for this card, and now, like, a month into having it, I started getting these emails almost every single day from them, and they start off like this. They say, "Dear Rebecca, we noticed that you left a really generous tip at insert restaurant or bar here.
Right.
And we just wanted to point it out to you in case it was a mistake or fraud," is basically what they're alleging. They assume that someone who leaves, say, $5
mm-hmm.
on a $14 bill, that can't really be something that humans would do?
I didn't even realize that was... I usually thought that credit card companies would email you if they're like, "Oh, we saw a charge at Tiffany's, Rebecca. You never shop there."
You know, I wouldn't, right? Yeah. That was a good one for me. Right, and so the email continues, like, "Here's how you can contact the restaurant if this is somehow an error." And what they're alleging is that it's unlikely that someone would have tipped $5 on 14, and therefore some poor server somewhere changed it on the bill and is trying to get away with that. That's what the emails are intimating.
That's strange. They're saying, "We think that maybe you should have tipped $3 and your server might have stolen $2 from
this
you."
This is basically what it is. And,
that's
and
really
if it
weird.
Had happened once, you know, it would have been a little weird. But I'm getting them almost every single day. I've been tweeting them out to publicly shame Capital One for shaming me
right.
for being a decent tipper. But I felt like it was time to do something about this and to not just call out the card company, but to use this as an educational moment because we've got a big anniversary this week. April 1st marks the 25th anniversary of the last time that Congress raised the tipped minimum wage. It's been stuck at $2.13 for 25 years. And so, hey, Capital One, if you think people can live on $2.13 an hour plus a little bit in tips, I've got news for you, and that's what we've lined up for this episode.
And I'm glad we're covering this because I think a lot of people still don't realize that tips are part of people's wages. They're not something extra that we're doing to say we appreciate your service. I was actually at a bar last night and a friend was saying, "That's actually a high tip for bar food." And, you know, so I think that we do have this culture that we think that, you know, tipping is just above optional. It's like a decent thing to do. No, this is how people are earning their living. And there's so many complicated issues with this. So I'm really glad that we're exploring it on this episode.
And first up, we're going to have David Cooper from the Economic Policy Institute, EPI. He's going to help give us a history of the tip minimum wage, which, as you pointed out, came into being and into law as basically a way for restaurants and other kinds of employers that have tipped workers on their payrolls to pay them less because the tips are sort of a form of credit, right? So we'll hear a little bit about how it came into being. And then you are going to be having a conversation with the executive director of DC Jobs with Justice.
Yes, we're going to be talking to Nikki Lewis, who's been on the program before. We're going to talk a little bit about her own experience as a tipped worker, but also what she's doing in DC to organize around these issues.
Well, I have to say, I'm really excited about this episode, not just because of the timeliness with the anniversary and all the excitement around Fight for 15 and the news out of California this week about raising the minimum wage to $15. But, you know, I was a server for a long time, and I take this stuff really personally. And anyone who thinks that you can live on $2.13 plus tips, I'd really love for you to try it.
Absolutely.
Capital One included. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. So to kick things off and help us get an understanding of 213 and what it's about, I'm joined in studio by David Cooper. He's a senior analyst with the Economic Policy Institute, better known as EPI. David, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So just to help us kind of get grounded in what the tipped minimum wage is, how it came about, give us a little bit of a layman's history of what the tipped minimum wage in this country is.
Sure. So the regular minimum wage is part of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is this very important legislation that passed in the late 1930s, coming out of the Depression, which established the minimum wage. It established the 40-hour work week. It established overtime, all kinds of great things. But originally, the Fair Labor Standards Act didn't apply to the service sector. So it was only in the 1960s that the Fair Labor Standards Act was extended to cover workers in the service sector. And when they did that, there was this deal made that at that time, you know, lawmakers and restaurant business owners in the service sector knew that a lot of their workers were getting tips as part of their income. So they created this exception essentially in the Fair Labor Standards Act saying that if you're going to extend this to our staff, we need to account for those tips that those workers are getting. We shouldn't have to pay the full minimum wage because we know our employees are already getting some income from tips. So what they did was they established it so that the minimum wage that applied to tipped workers was essentially 50% of the regular minimum wage. So in other words, employers could take a credit of 50% against what they were required to pay per hour to their tipped staff, so long as those tips equated when you added those tips to their base wage, they were getting at least the regular minimum wage. And over time, this relationship basically held steady through most of the 1970s, the 1980s, where tipped workers, even as they raised the regular minimum wage, the tipped minimum wage was still connected to the regular minimum wage, so that when the regular minimum wage was raised, say, up to $4.25 per hour, the tipped workers saw their tipped minimum wage raised to $2.13 per hour. Well, what happened? The problem was that in the 1990s, when there was this debate in Congress about raising the regular minimum wage, at the time they were trying to get the federal minimum wage raised to $5.75. Well, you may remember Herman Cain. A few years ago, Herman Cain was...
How could we forget
exactly.
Herman Cain?
999
right. Will stick with all of us forever.
At the time, Herman Cain was the head of the National Restaurant Association, and Herman Cain first came to prominence in some sense because he was able to get this modification in the tip minimum wage law. At the time, the tip minimum wage was set at 50% of the regular minimum wage, which at the time was $4.25, so the tip minimum wage was $2.13. Herman Cain got them to basically say, okay, if you're going to raise the regular minimum wage, go ahead, but let's keep the tip minimum wage frozen at $2.13. Let's break this link where it's always set at 50% of the regular minimum wage. So ever since then, as we've raised the regular minimum wage, that tip minimum wage has just been stuck at $2.13.
So basically what you're saying is we're still partying like it's 1991.
That's correct.
When it comes to the tip minimum wage.
Exactly. The tip minimum wage has not changed in 25 years.
And in that interim, in that same period of time, the federal minimum wage, the regular minimum wage, has been increased 5 times, if I'm counting correctly.
That's right. So, right. We took the federal minimum wage up to $7.25, which is still too low.
Right.
But yeah, now at this point, employers are essentially getting a larger credit against what they have to pay their workers than what the workers themselves are actually getting as a minimum wage. The tip minimum wage now is only equal to, I think it's 29% of the regular minimum wage. So far from where it was back in the early 90s.
And I want to have you help us get a sense of who are we talking about when mm-hmm. we talk about tipped workers.
Sure.
I think, you know, many of our listeners might, like me, be former or current servers.
Right.
We think of restaurant workers. Who are tipped workers in this country?
Yeah, so there's roughly 4.5 million tipped workers of some variety in this country, and the vast majority of them are in restaurants, food service, waiters, waitresses, bartenders. But there's also other tipped workers. You think of nail salon attendants is another big one, barbershop workers, hair salon workers, even massage therapists, and although they may be getting more than the regular tip minimum wage, taxi drivers in a lot of cases are tipped workers, and even casino workers. So the people that are dealing cards at casinos are often tipped workers. And the law states that as long as that worker is getting at least $30 per month in tips, then they can qualify as a tipped worker such that their employer can pay them as little as $2.13 an hour.
I want to make you repeat that just because I actually I didn't even know that until this week in prepping for this episode and some of what the Center for American Progress is doing to both commemorate and shame Congress for the 25th anniversary of the last time we raised the tip minimum wage. Repeat that horrible provision of the law.
Yeah, so the law says in order for a worker to qualify as a tipped worker such that they can be paid less than the regular minimum wage, they have to only make $30 per month in tips. And that's, I mean, that's shocking. But what's really frightening about that also is that you may have started to see there's some activity to try and increase tipping in other occupations. There was a bit of a news kerfluffle a few years ago when Marriott started encouraging more people to tip their service staff, to tip the maids cleaning their rooms. And, you know, we don't know what Marriott's motivations were. I mean, maybe they just wanted their workers to feel more appreciated. Fine. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt. But the reality is that if those workers started making at least $30 per month in tips, technically they could be paid less than the full minimum wage as long as the employer could document that.
And there are some types of occupations that aren't even ones where tipping is visibly encouraged or even, you know, clearly permitted. One that I came across earlier this week was wheelchair attendants at airports.
Yeah.
Often those people will actually not be permitted to tell you that they're even allowed to take tips, but because they might get $30 a month in tips, they end up getting that $2.13 an hour for what can be really grueling work.
Yeah, the bottom line is that this whole tipping system, this separate labor standard that applies to tipping, really just creates a giant gray zone where we really don't know what's going on. I've heard it called the wild, wild west of labor standards because there is so much ambiguity about who qualifies, what's the employer's responsibility, how do we track this? There's a host of problems associated with this separate system.
So we were talking about who tipped workers are, and you were walking through some of the types of occupations that mm-hmm. they might be in. But give us a snapshot of the demographics. Who are these people?
Sure. So as I said, about two-thirds of tipped workers are in food service. The majority of them are women. So about two-thirds of these workers, tipped workers overall, are women. They tend to be a little bit younger than the rest of the workforce, but they're not as young as sometimes you think. In fact, the majority of them are 25 or older. A lot of these folks are supporting families. If you look at the restaurant industry, about a quarter of tipped workers are parents. And they're actually more likely, tipped workers are more likely to be single parents than regular workers, which is another reason why, looking at labor conditions, looking at labor policies as it relates to tipped workers is so critical, because these are folks that are trying to make ends meet and oftentimes have children.
And so we've been talking a lot about $2.13 an hour and how low that is. And you mentioned that there's a requirement to top up workers mm-hmm. if their tips don't end up reaching the minimum wage.
Right.
I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb and guess that might not always happen.
Yeah, it's really tricky, and that's the thing, is that the law is so ambiguous about this. There's such a gray area that I've heard it said, you know, I've heard it from employers that they have a hard time knowing whether they're in compliance with the law. So basically what the law says is, again, for each week that a tipped worker works, whatever their tips are, you take that, you add it to the 213 base wage that they're supposed to be getting off the bat. And if that doesn't add up to at least the regular minimum wage per hour, then their employer is supposed to give them more per hour to compensate. The problem is that how do you enforce that? How do you track it? If a worker wanted to make sure that they were getting paid appropriately, they would have to keep track of all their tips, both on credit cards and in cash, record their hours that they worked for the week, add in that 213 base wage, and do the math and make sure that they were getting at least the regular minimum wage. But we don't know how they're supposed to count, say, tips that they're passing on to other workers in the restaurant, like busboys or barbacks that might be supporting them. How do we account for that? It's not clear. And the worst part is that if they figure out that they've been underpaid, that they've made less than minimum wage, the onus is on the employee to go to their manager, to go to their employer and say, hey, you didn't pay me enough. And you have to remember, these are the managers that are setting their schedule, that are determining what, you know, sections of the restaurant they're going to be working in, determining whether they keep their job.
And those things that you just mentioned, which might sound just like kind of logistical components of your day, I mean, which shifts you get can determine how much you make in tips. Thursday, Friday, Saturday night can be dramatically different from Monday night or Tuesday lunch or something, where, you know, you can end up sitting around on your hands and not seeing anybody for tables.
Exactly. And that's, I mean, any restaurant worker will tell you, any server will tell you that they'd much rather have a Friday night or a Saturday night than a Tuesday lunch. Requiring the employee to have to police this is just outrageous. And we know that as a consequence of this, there are a lot of violations. The Department of Labor does compliance checks with restaurants periodically. And the last time they did a sweep like this, they found there were 1,500 violations across all the restaurants that they checked with. They recovered, I think it was about $15.5 million in wages that were owed to tipped workers for these violations. And that's just a small sample of what the larger problem could be, because obviously the Department of Labor doesn't have enough investigators to go and check out every claim.
And we've talked a little bit at points on this show about wage theft, mm-hmm. and really the epidemic that it presents across this country. It's primarily in tipped occupations where wage theft can occur.
Well, it happens a lot in tipped occupations, that's for sure, because there's such a gray area.
So thinking a little bit about sort of what the consequences are of the tipped minimum wage and of tipped workers ending up being needlessly economically precarious, mm-hmm. I want to ask, do we have numbers that kind of help us understand the scope of
sure.
this? Maybe, poverty rates
right.
or public assistance? Help us kind of paint a picture.
Yeah, so we actually do know, and we have good data, good evidence showing the consequences of this policy. And you kind of, you touched on it when you said it's precarious, it's needlessly precarious. That really gets at the core of it, because if your income is dependent almost entirely on tips, then there's tremendous instability in how much income you're getting, because you never know what you're going to make in tips in any given night. Your schedule might change week to week. You know, the weather might turn bad and you have a slow week, and there's just no way for you to know. And so if you don't know what your income's going to be, how do you budget? How do you plan? And so as a consequence of that, when we look at poverty rates among tipped workers, they're dramatically higher than poverty rates for non-tipped workers. So let me give you some numbers. Among tipped workers, the poverty rate is 14.5%. For non-tipped workers, it's about 6.5%, so more than double the poverty rate of non-tipped workers. But if we look just at waiters, waitresses, and bartenders, so just focusing on folks in food service, it's even a little bit higher than that, so 14.9. What's interesting, though, is that, you know, in some states, tipped workers are guaranteed the regular minimum wage. So this 213 policy is not uniform across the country. There's seven states where tipped workers are required to be paid the full minimum wage before tips. Most of these are on the West Coast, but you also have, so it's California, Washington, Oregon, Montana, Minnesota, and I'm forgetting the other one. I think Alaska is the last one. So in those states, tipped workers get full minimum wage plus tips. And if you look at the poverty rates among tipped workers in those states, it's dramatically lower than in the states where they're getting the 213. So in the 213 states, on average, tipped waiters, waitresses, and bartenders have a poverty rate of about 18%. In the states where they get regular minimum wage before tips, their poverty rate is only about 10%, so 8 percentage points lower. And what's really fascinating is that if you look at the poverty rates among all workers, comparing those two categories of states, it's about the same. So what that means is this tipped policy is really directly responsible for those higher poverty rates in the 213 states.
So we've heard a lot over the last couple of years about the fight for 15. Mm-hmm. There's been this very public, very, in many cases, successful fight to raise the minimum wage. You don't hear so much about raising the tip minimum wage. Our efforts across the country in states, in cities, you know, most recently the big news this week was California, moving to raise its minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Right.
Are those movements, are those efforts inclusive of efforts to raise the tipped minimum wage too, or are tipped folks getting left behind?
Well, unfortunately, in the past, they've been left behind time and time again, and it really is frustrating, I think, both for tipped workers and for people who follow this policy. The most recent example I can think of is just a few years ago, Maryland raised its minimum wage up to $10.10 and did essentially the same thing that the federal government did back in the 90s, where they just froze their tipped minimum wage at what it was, and that was really frustrating. But now, as a consequence of this, there is greater awareness of this tip minimum wage policy. And so when we look at the last time there was the last bill that was put forward to raise the federal minimum wage, the $12 by 2020 bill.
The Murray Scott bill.
That's right. That included a provision that would have gradually raised the tip minimum wage until it was eliminated. So essentially, the tip minimum wage right now is $2.13. It would have raised it slowly year after year until it eventually equaled the same as the regular minimum wage, and we would just do away with this policy. And you're seeing a lot of activity at the state level to adopt similar proposals. So in California, tip workers there already get the full minimum wage, so it's not really an issue. But in other states where proposals have been put forward to raise the regular minimum wage, they've adopted the same mindset of let's slowly phase out this tipped minimum wage because it's just bad policy.
Now, in the last couple of minutes that I have with you, I want to play devil's advocate for
sure.
a second and put on my Herman Cain hat,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm the employer. I'm the restaurant.
Right.
And I think this is really bad for business.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that if we raise or even eliminate the tip minimum wage, that it's going to put me out of business. It's
right.
going to slow job growth or, you know, let me really put the hat on. It's going to kill jobs.
Right.
Right. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, so the researchers have looked at this, and it just doesn't play out. You know, when people have looked for changes in employment in the restaurant industry resulting from increases in the tip minimum wage, they don't find anything. They don't find any effects. And in fact, when you look at job growth in restaurants from the period of about 1990 to I think it's 2014, job growth was actually stronger in the states where tipped workers get the regular minimum wage before tips than it was in the states where they're being paid $2.13 an hour. So in other words, in these states where tipped workers are treated like everybody else, job growth is faster.
My guest is David Cooper. He's a senior analyst and tipped minimum wage guru at the Economic Policy Institute. David, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Tracy Ross. On today's episode, we're discussing the tipped minimum wage, which has remained at just $2.13 since 1991. I'm joined by Nikki Lewis, who is the executive director of DC Jobs with Justice, to discuss this further. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tracy.
So I know that you got your career started in the restaurant industry, so I just thought we would start there, and I'd be curious from your own work experiences, what it was like for you surviving off of a tipped minimum wage.
Sure, absolutely. I started working in the restaurant industry I should say I started working in the hospitality industry as a child. It runs in my family. My grandmother my grandmother was the owner of several bed and breakfasts in the Mid-Atlantic region. So that's really where I got my start, cooking and cleaning and just taking care of people. So by the time I was 15 and of legal age to work, I got a job as a hostess at a restaurant in the Hagerstown Valley Mall at the time, and it was Friendly's. And at the time I was in high school, the wage then was still $2.13 federally. But of course, in high school, I was fortunate to have a stable home, and my mother took care of the housing and most of the food bills. So the income that I made was very supplemental at the time. It helped me to save for college, to get some books. It helped me to, you know, buy my own clothes and help out with food at the house to take some burden off my mom. And after that point, though, I was fortunate to go to the University of Maryland, and throughout that whole time, I continued to work part-time in the restaurant industry like so many other students do. So I continued that path once I was in college, and things got tougher then, because then I was more responsible for my housing, food, and transportation. I graduated, though, but by this time, I lived in Washington, D.C., so I had Washington, D.C. rent to pay, and phone bills, and transportation, and food, etc. And really, the wage stayed the same. So now I'm talking, I know I just summarized a lot, but I'm talking about a 10-year period, basically, from going through high school, graduating through college, and then moving to the District of Columbia and just getting back into the restaurant industry. For 10 years, no wage ever went up, so I continually just lived off of tips. There was never any paid sick days. So I went to work along with a lot of other colleagues repeatedly, being sick with the cold or sometimes worse. I definitely bartended once, having pink eye, highly contagious, for fear of losing my job. Those issues, amongst other, are problems that are, I see them as problems in an industry. There is something that I thought were, it's just the way that it was for quite a long time, until I started meeting other restaurant workers who had a critique
sure.
on that.
And I think it kind of following your aging through the restaurant industry process, going from a high school student where it seemed like, well, maybe this is just acceptable and it's supplemental income, to realizing there are people that are supporting families and don't have their rent covered by a parent or relative, mm-hmm. really, I think, illuminates just how this wage isn't enough. So what did you learn from the people that you were working with?
Actually, so what the reason that I started coming together with people is interesting in and of itself. I was a dog walker and a bartender, and I had a bicycling accident and I broke my foot. And then I was on crutches, and I didn't have any health insurance either. So I went through that, and that uplifted my consciousness to be like, whoa, why don't I have any health insurance, you know? But I work full-time, and I work hard, too. So that enlightened me, and then I was looking for opportunities to make money, because I still had to pay my rent through having a broken foot. And that's when I came across the Restaurant Opportunity Center of Washington, D.C., and I went in for a member orientation to learn about the classes that they have. They teach classes for fine dining, serving, for bartending, and I had over 10 years of experience, so I knew I could teach a class. I went in there and really connected with other folks that were talking about the lack of the pay raises, the lack of paid sick days, the lack of health care, but also the amount of sexual harassment that regularly happens to women, the amount of health and just kind of dangerous situations people are in around knives and slippery floors, and also about the discrimination that happens in the restaurant industry, whether it's racial or ethnicity based or immigration status, or even based on your accent. All of these different issues were happening in an industry. And then I did, I participated in a research project with Rock, where we talked to a pool of random over 500 restaurant workers, and then I saw a pattern. Like everyone, whether they were in fast food to the finest dining restaurant, like everyone hadn't got a raise.
So you mentioned a variety of things that you learned at Rock that I want to unpack, starting with the sexual harassment. So reports show that the restaurant industry is the single largest source of sexual harassment complaints, and many of the incidents go unreported because workers fear retaliation from customers who might not tip them or from their employers. Can you explain a little bit what you witnessed and what you heard about sexual harassment with regard to the restaurant industry?
Sure. It's just, unfortunately, it's a culture that is commonly accepted in the industry, and because of the reasons that you said, there's a dynamic, particularly for women in tipped positions, that their livelihood is based on their manager or their customer's perception of them, in making sure that person feels hospitable, that it's a place of hospitality. It's not a place, oftentimes, where you want to check people on their gender politics, you know, because you need them to tip you or you need them to give you an adequate schedule so that you have enough hours or that you get a good section. So the power dynamic, I think, is what helps enable that culture to persist.
We know that food servers and bartenders who make up half of the tip workforce, that 70% of those servers and bartenders are women. So
yeah,
it's an industry where a lot of people are particularly vulnerable.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned race and immigration status. So I imagine with regard to immigration, that same kind of vulnerability plays out. Did you see much of that as well when you started going to Rock?
Absolutely. And I saw it long before I became a member of Rock. Actually, when I was working in a very popular downtown D.C. restaurant, the majority of the back-of-the-house workers were Latino, as well as the bar backs, bussers, and food runners. And I can't tell you how many times I would see certain workers come to the office and request their check, and the manager would tell them that they didn't have it, that there was some kind of holdup from the corporate office. But they would be told this like time and time and again. And so it was just blatant wage theft. And the workers were afraid to say anything or stand up about it, depending on their immigration status. And also just whether, you know, regardless of your immigration status or not, again, it's the power dynamic of I need a job. A lot of these folks are in very low wage positions. Any money income is like helpful, you know, and so they don't want to risk or jeopardize losing that little bit of income or being blacklisted in applying for other jobs in the same industry.
You also mentioned scheduling in there. What are the compounding effects of all of these issues in the context of getting paid at such a low wage?
Yeah, it really puts people's economic stability on the line. People are living in this industry from day to day. Not all, but in Washington, D.C., we found about only 13% of restaurant workers in D.C. actually have a living wage in some form of benefits. So overwhelming majority of folks are definitely dealing with the instability of these compounded issues. When you don't have adequate health insurance, when you don't have a guaranteed day off to take care of yourself or a family member, when your wages are stagnant since 1991, and then when you're dealing with making money as a tip person on the good graces of a guest, what ends up happening is that you can't plan for things. You never know when you're going to be able to pay for all of your bills. You are constantly playing a juggling game. It compounds your credit. It compounds everything. In terms of the hours and scheduling, what we see more and more today is employers relying on meeting the demands of the market on a day-to-day on-call basis. And so what that means is that employers are getting schedules out to employees later and later. It means that more employees are becoming on-call employees. They might be needed to work, and they have to hold their schedule until the employer calls them that same day to let them know if they have to come in. So it prevents them from being able to do anything else, making money, getting an education, planning for childcare. And we see more and more employers also relying on part-time workforces so that it prevents them from giving full-time benefits to people. And so all of these things are happening, and it's making folks have to get two and three jobs. Or a lot of people are just saying, like, forget about it. It's too much.
So what are some of the things that you're doing with DC Jobs with Justice to address some of these issues?
Well, over the past couple of years, we've built community and labor-based coalitions to do a couple of things, four things actually. One is pass some legislation that increases these rights for folks. So we've increased the city's minimum wage to $11.50. We have won a wage theft prevention law so that when these things go down, people have a legal recourse to gain their money back. We've helped support winning the paid sick days bill that covers all restaurant workers. So we've passed some legislation. The second thing we've done is work on implementing those pieces of legislation. And that's really about educating people about what their rights are and where to go and what to do if their rights are violated. And the other piece we've been doing is trying to support workers who are organizing. You know, we're a coalition of a whole bunch of different organizations, so there's a lot moving on the ground in D.C. We're continuously trying to plug diverse workers' fights into other workers' fights so that they can feel as a movement and know that they're not alone with these things and actually get concrete results. And the other thing that we're doing right now is working with our coalition partners on some new legislation that will take things even farther. We're working on an hours and scheduling bill. We're working with our partners at Jews United for Justice on a paid family medical leave bill. And we're supporting ROC DC and the Working Families Organization on the DC for 15 campaign. So it's a lot, but it's important.
Given the traction that you've seen with so many of your efforts, do you feel like the public and also restaurant owners themselves are becoming, I guess, much more aware about the plight of workers in this city?
I think that they are becoming more aware, but it's taking time. It's definitely taking time. We're fortunate here in D.C. that we have a generally progressive base of people that live here or that want to move here to move things forward locally and for, the national scene. But even with the traction that we've made, DC Jobs of Justice, even though we're a coalition of a lot of organizations, we have a small staff. And so to really reach the groundswell of letting people know what their rights are and how to organize, that's a long and strenuous and ongoing fight that that'll be for the rest of our lives.
Nikki Lewis is the executive director of DC Jobs with Justice. Thank you so much for joining, and we'll definitely be following the progress on that piece of legislation.
Great. Thanks so much.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we are currently in our video utility room with Alan Pike of Think Progress.
Hello, hello.
It's an interesting locale.
A new setting,
yes.
But,
it's got that dampening foam on the walls. It's very exciting.
I feel like we need to take some selfies in here and tweet them.
So people can understand
of how special this place
is. But, this represents that the show must go on.
Yeah.
Our radio studio is currently occupied, but we wanted to be able to provide an installment of the Weekly Words.
Wherever you imagine us when you listen to this segment, normal weeks, just imagine us in a slightly funnier place.
Exactly.
With slightly more styrofoam.
And for people who are tuning in for the first time, the way that the Weekly Worst works is that Alan Pike brings three articles to our attention that are horrible related to poverty. Sometimes they're articles he's written, and we vote on which one's the worst.
And the articles themselves might not be horrible. They might
right.
be great,
they're on horrible
but
they're subjects.
About bad things.
Good clarification, because
yes.
we like the all the people who write these articles.
The articles Except come Alan. From thinkprogress.org, so let's hope they're never horrible. Not just
that is
not
correct.
Necessarily
they are
horrible,
fantastic.
Rebecca.
They are crack
there it is. That's
journalism.
The stuff. Give me more.
Okay, so
Alan,
what is your first story?
Your first terrific but awful
yes.
story.
This one actually, this is ugly stuff. So Jeffrey Pendleton was just 26 years old when he died mysteriously in a New Hampshire jail cell earlier this month. He was only there because he didn't have $100 to make bail. He was arrested on a misdemeanor pot possession charge. This was a homeless guy who worked at Burger King in Nashua, New Hampshire, found dead in his jail cell in mid-March, and authorities claim that his body showed no signs of trauma. His family says otherwise and says they've had a second autopsy done that indicates somebody did him in, but we haven't been able to confirm that. But on a Friday afternoon in late March, a group of his coworkers from the Burger King and solidarity protesters and friends marched on the jail where he died to demand answers. Jeffrey was a member of the Fight for 15 movement, organizing to try to push for higher wages for fast food workers and potential unionization rights. And it's a tragic story that's not over yet because we still genuinely don't know what happened to him. And in some ways, it's also, to me, potentially at least, an inspiring story if it can start to bring together the two most exciting sort of ground level organizing projects going on right now in the progressive space or around progressive values, which are obviously the Fight for 15 movement and the work that Black Lives Matter organizers have been doing all around the country to try to draw attention to cases like Jeffrey's, where people of color die mysteriously or not so mysteriously at the hands of law enforcement.
But it also brings in a whole other set of issues, right? Which is that debtors' prisons are alive and well in this
yes.
country, despite the fact that they were declared unconstitutional decades ago in
right.
the United States by the Supreme Court. They are alive and well because we have states and localities across the country that, instead of levying taxes on people who can afford them in progressive tax policy fashion, they, and we've discussed this on the show repeatedly, go after largely poor black and brown people for whether it's traffic offenses or whether it's fines and fees that get tacked on to involvement with the criminal justice system. I mean, this came to light obviously with Ferguson, but it's happening everywhere across the country. And and what these fines and fees, which can be unaffordable for not just low income people, but people of even some means, what they end up spelling is a path either to or back to jail.
Right.
And I wish this were the first case of its kind, but
right.
there's one of these almost every
right,
week
right.
or every month
yeah.
of someone literally dying in debtor's prison in 2016 in the United
yeah.
States. Oh,
remind me, how much was, what was his debt?
$100 bail.
Yeah, and so this is a minimum wage worker. We know that there's nowhere in the U.S. where a minimum wage worker can afford a two-bedroom apartment. If you think about all the possible expenses that this man had, the fact that he was part of the Fight for 15 movement, it's just the extreme cost of being poor in this country is increasingly your life. It's not even just that you're sentenced to a life of poverty, that you're driven deeper into poverty. The fact that we keep seeing jail as a solution or a response to poverty is frightening, because there's obviously some deeply rooted systemic and structural issues at play that he should have never been in prison, you know, or in jail. I understand that the circumstances surrounding his death are still, you know, somewhat mysterious, but it should have never even gotten to that
exactly.
part. The fact that we're trying to figure out what happened, he shouldn't have been in jail.
And I mentioned fines and fees, but it overlaps with the cash bail situation,
right?
Mm-hmm. Because
yeah.
we have cash bail in most jurisdictions in this country. Actually, D.C. is an exception. For the most part,
right.
D.C. does not use cash bail in criminal cases. And what you end up finding is that instead of setting up a two-tiered system of justice, which is what happens
right.
when people who are too poor to post bail end up being in jail waiting for their day in court, whereas the people who can afford bail get the pleasure of being free until
mm-hmm.
their trial date, right? That's a two-tiered system of justice, definition of it. But what you find in D.C. that doesn't have that cash bail system is actually people, by and large, show up for their court date. There's also really important research finding that people who end up doing jail time before they are sentenced to a crime are
right.
much more likely to be sentenced and are much more likely to do more time in jail or
right,
prison down
right,
the road. It's
right.
something called cumulative disadvantage. And so there's all these reasons why cash bail has got to go.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it's something policymakers are looking at doing. But Tracy, you hit the nail on the head
right.
by
and
saying people are paying with their lives.
And one thing that you mentioned, Alan, that we haven't in our discussion full yet is that you said he was facing homelessness, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's part of what's so fascinating about Mr. Pendleton's story from the little bit of information that I was able to dig up and other reporters have found out. He according, this is all according to a GoFundMe page that his family set up. His family is not prepared
yeah.
yet to talk to reporters, which is totally understandable. But he's actually from, I believe, Arkansas, maybe Alabama, I think Arkansas, and so was a long ways from home. And his family says they had no idea that he was in such dire financial straits up in Nashua, New Hampshire. They didn't realize that he was on the street. Every time they talked to him, he would say, you know, I'm doing fine, I'm working. It's heartbreaking stuff it sort of punctures the stereotypical notions we have of poor people in general, of homeless people specifically, of fast food kitchen staff, which is, you know, the stereotype is that these are folks who if they were just willing to work a little harder, if they just didn't have so much they had a little more pride in themselves. They took a little more pride in their lives. They'd be able to overcome these disadvantages that they're facing because this is America. The reality is, this is a guy who had so much pride that he wasn't willing to ask for help from his family, even though he was sleeping on the streets, hundreds and hundreds of miles away from home, and picking up whatever hours he was allowed to take at a job that pays, like you say, not enough to live on any place. It's really crushing stuff.
I can't imagine a worse story, but we're going to go to the next story that you have for us.
Yeah, I guess I should have saved that for last for the sake of the game. But we'll see. Okay, so second up. If you're rich, you can basically buy your kid a seat in her school's gifted and talented program. Apparently, it costs about $1,000 to have a private psychologist do a test on your child for intellect and the other things that qualify a kid for gifted and talented programs. And my colleague Casey Quinlan had a feature up this week on thinkprogress.org about how these programs end up walling out students of color regardless of their qualifications. So we're replicating disparities in access and opportunity along racial and income lines, even as early as, you know, that first grade, second grade, third grade sort of walling off of or tracking of students.
So what's happening is, if you can afford to get your child labeled as gifted, then you can go forward on that process. So there's obviously, you know, students from low-income backgrounds who are probably doing well in their first, second, third grade classes who just are, from the jump, weeded out of this testing. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of the equivalent of, it sounds like a quasi-bribery sort of a thing. Essentially, it's a lot like, well, I don't want to actually go through the rigmarole of getting my certification to be an auto mechanic, but I know a guy who prints up the certificates, and if I give him $600, then I will appear to be a licensed auto mechanic.
Actually something you've done, though, to be clear.
No, although I am really bad at working on cars.
So if you were going to go that route,
yes,
you would have
would,
to know
I
a guy.
I would have to commit a crime, okay, yes. Well, no, but we've converted this label that's supposed to be about intrinsic qualities of a child's intellectual capacity or artistic capacity or whatever else into one that's really about class status
and one that's commodified.
Yeah, because
you can have two kids who have the same test scores, you know, in their regular classwork and are performing the same level, but just have two different labels because one was able to afford a label.
Right.
Which only just further exacerbates educational disparities that already exist across income and class lines and racial lines.
Right, right,
I mean,
exactly.
That's what this promises to do.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of those stories that sort of underscores how far we've gone as a country away from what our mythos about being an opportunity society and a meritocracy, and we've leaned so far away from that even something as fundamentally sort of egalitarian as, okay, which of these kids has the most interesting brain, and they'll distract the other kids if we leave them in a normal class.
I know that
into
this is
a stalking horse for who's rich and who's not.
I know this is serious, but so I do.
But
whenever I do improv, I feel like I end up doing this character, which in my head is this wealthy New York mother who's always having her, like, competing with the other moms in the PTA about how, Madison or Buffy is better than their daughter. And so now I just feel like if that character comes up again, I have some more material. So I appreciate that.
Apologies to any listeners named either Madison or Buffy that we may have.
Particularly if they have mothers in New York, or if they are mothers
or
in New York.
Or they are mothers in New York. Right. But
any resemblance to real persons is absolutely
coincidental.
I think you should shake it up maybe a little bit with, like, the Texas cheerleader mom.
There we go.
Like, actually willing to kill to get her daughter on the squad.
I love that you want a,
that
a,
sounds like a
dark
movie.
Improv.
It's based on real events.
God
catch
bless
up.
America.
I apologize for taking us down this route, so we'll go on to the third and final story.
Four Ohio women.
Like, should I?
I know. I was like, the suspense.
Rebecca can see my notes, so she would know what's about to happen here. This is going to be fun. Four Ohio women want their tampon money back. In a lawsuit filed this month, a group of women are demanding reimbursement from the state for sales taxes charged on tampons and other standard women's health products. The suit estimates that 3 million Ohio women spend $70 each per year on the products and pay a combined $11 million a year in sales taxes. The so-called tampon tax is a broader problem than just Ohio, though. Many states that exempt other health necessities from sales taxes nonetheless assess them on basic women's health products.
Alan, it sounds like you listened to last week's episode.
Damn it.
I'll just say, I giggled at the top of it for also because people couldn't see that Rebecca basically put a power fist in the air in response to this women putting this lawsuit forward because the tampon tax is a issue close to your heart.
It is an issue close to my heart, and not just because I'm a woman.
Thing.
This is a thing.
Yeah.
Alan, so, okay, so first of all,
this is a very stereotypical boy thing that I'm doing here.
It is, and I
ignoring
really
stories that involve the word tampon.
I
genuinely had no idea this was a thing. It's absurd
so
and infuriating.
You are proving everything we said in last week's episode, and now you get to go
here
back
to
and listen to it and be like, "That was me," which we will especially enjoy if we could do that as a group activity.
Okay.
Yes.
So, free the tampons. That's the movement, right? Because sales taxes are incredibly regressive, and the fact that a basic necessity that is not a luxury item, you know, use female sanitary products that half of the country need to use during their years of fertility, it's obscene, right? And so there's a movement afoot across the country, as folks heard last week, to free the tampons from those taxes, but also to increase access to sanitary products more broadly, because low-income women and girls actually can have a lot of trouble accessing them, even though, you know, you think $80 a year for these kinds of things isn't that expensive. But if you're struggling to make your food stamps last all month, and you're struggling to afford your rent and your, you know, other expenses,
these things add up really quickly.
I read about this and I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Like, this seems like something from the era when, you know, cigarette ads had a guy in a doctor's coat going,
it's good for you.
It's great for my T-zone or whatever. In what possible universe could a supposedly advanced society not consider these items to be like health necessities, like medical products?
I have an answer for you, and we came up, we discussed this at length in last week's Female Power Free the Tampons episode, which is a society where men make the policy.
I was getting ready to say the patriarchy in unison. I was like, I don't know which which feminist phrase we're about to use. So
please,
I think
all of them.
Everyone who missed out on last week's episode should go and revisit it, because we dive deeper into this, but I think it's time.
Tweet your thoughts to Alan.
Yes.
at Pike A with a Y.
P-Y-K-E. A.
That's correct.
Beautiful. All right, so now it's time to vote.
I'm voting for the dying in a jail cell. Sorry,
I'm assuming it's unanimous. Alan?
No, I'm going to vote for the tampons thing because I'm still so awestruck as a lame, ignorant boy about this, and B, because it allows me to... Hey-o. Well played. And B, because the other thing I wanted to say is that, like, this is like I'm really only aware of how idiotic this is, in part because, like, my mother, who's going to retire later this year and loves to sew and has a ton of like fancy sewing machines in her home, got plugged in with a group of people that makes durable menstrual pads for girls in Kenya who get pulled out of school if they start showing visible signs of menstruation.
We're with you, Mama Pike.
And that obviously, you know, helps derail women's development throughout that society. That we could be doing something that even reminds me of that in this country is absurd.
You will hear when you go back and group listen with us to last week's episode, not just Kenya, right? Like, here you've
got girls who are skipping
school, having truancy issues and academic completion issues because they're ashamed and embarrassed because they can't actually, you know, take the
steps
they need.
I'm sorry. On behalf of dudes as a class,
without losing sight of it, the Weekly Worst was the first story.
Yes.
And I think we'll be definitely following that one, but I think you're right when you talked about the convergence of the fight for 15 and Black Lives Matter movement. And we'll see what comes from this. But
and folks who haven't seen it should check out Attorney General Loretta Lynch's words on this issue. She actually issued an incredibly strongly worded letter to state court administrators and other state officials about how we need to stop being a country that has debtors' prisons.
Amen.
And it's long past time. So
absolutely. All right. right. Well, thanks, Alan. And we'll look forward to having you back.
Absolutely.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clocks by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford 'cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough.